Okay, ladies and gentlemen, lovely to see you all. So welcome to another evening in the series on Heroes of the Dharma. So you would have heard last week about the refuge tree, which Jamaka spoke about. And so that's our year-long theme about Heroes of the Dharma. And that's broken down into a number of mini-seasons of a few weeks. And tonight is the first evening of one of these mini-seasons. And the theme for this mini-season is Nagarjuna and the Perfection of Wisdom. And if that doesn't really mean much to you, that's great, really, because that's why we're here, to introduce that theme. So this evening I will be just introducing that theme, Nagarjuna and the Perfection of Wisdom. Next week we'll have Singhanada, who will be giving a talk in more depth, or a more in-depth talk about the topic. Week three we'll have myself and Bodhi Pushpa, who will be talking about the Heart Sutra, which you may well be familiar with, you may well have chanted on one or more occasions. So we'll be going into that, in particular the emotional connections and how we can practice with the Heart Sutra, how we can use it as a basis for practice in our everyday lives. So that's week three. Week four will be Singhanada part two, where we go into even more depth about one of the topics. And then week five will be, I'll be leading that week, and it will be, well, it's kind of open at the moment. It may be about the topic of emptiness, but really, I suppose, it's if there's anything that you feel that you would like to cover that we've missed, that we haven't done, that we haven't clarified enough, that you think would be useful to find out about, then by all means let me or another member of the team know, because week five is quite open at the moment, and so I'd like to just do what's needed on week five, really, to make the most of it. But this evening, it's Nagarjuna and the Perfection of Wisdom. So let's take ourselves back, as we sometimes do on these occasions, to the time of the Buddha, 2,600 years ago. And it's another baking hot day in the plains of northern India. And if you can imagine, there's a line of hills that roll incongruously across the plains of northern India. Steep hills, although not particularly high. Nestled in a cleft in those hills is the town of Rajgir. And Rajgir is the capital of the kingdom of Magadha. And on this day, the Buddha sets out from the town and begins to ascend the hills, as is often his custom. And sometimes he does this in order to find some solitude, to be by himself, to reflect or to meditate. But on other occasions, such as today, he goes to give a teaching. So he is accompanied by a multitude of people. Perhaps even King Bimbisara himself is climbing the hills, or other members of the royal family or the court. Maybe there's some rich merchants and their wives and families in their fine robes. No doubt there's plenty of rank-and-file people from the town, ordinary workers and so on. And there may even be, there probably are, some of the outcasts from around the town as well, because of course the Buddha's teaching is suitable for everybody. And so they all climb the hill in the heat till they arrive at the point known as Vulture's Peak, which is a favourite point of the Buddha's, where he liked to give his teachings from time to time. And so there they are, this multitude of people with the eagles and the vultures circling overhead on the thermals. But they're not the only people there. They're not the only beings there. Also are numerous gods and goddesses, dakas and dakinis, bodhisattvas, all forms of mythical beings there too, to hear the Buddha speak. And the Buddha does speak. And on this particular day, he gives a teaching so profound, so deep, so subtle, that he decides that actually the world isn't ready for this. It's, as they used to say in the 60s, too much. So what he decides to do is he calls forth the Naga king from the deep oceans And he presents the Naga King with this teaching for his safekeeping. And the Naga King takes it back down with him into the deepest ocean where it will be safe. Until the time is right and one is born who is able to realize this profound teaching and pass it on to the rest of the world. And so the centuries go by till eventually the time is right, the world is ready, and a person is born who is able to realize the teaching. That person is Nagarjuna, known often as the second Buddha. And the teaching is the Prajnaparamita, or perfection of wisdom. So that's the legendary story of the perfection of wisdom. Let's now just look at the historical context as well. So I'm going to go to my big board, and if you can imagine, down here we've got, this is a very rough drawing of the Buddha, but that's the Buddha, and so this represents the time of the Buddha, and time obviously continues upwards until the present day, until now. So, upon the death of the Buddha, obviously the teaching carried on and arrived with us at the present day. And it went through various... Well, it carried on to reach us at the present day, but there were various, unfortunately, there were various schisms within the Sangha. So it wasn't quite a straight line. There were various schools that arose, various offshoots, that generally disagreed about, well, what I would tend to consider to be relatively minor things, but nevertheless, various different emphases and points of disagreement arose. So there was a number of schools of Buddhism that arose in those early centuries following the death of the Buddha. And collectively, they're known as Hinayana. Now that's a slightly derogatory term because it means lesser way. But it's the only term I've got to hand that collectively describes these schools, so that's what I'm going to stick with. And it's a term that you hear a lot in any case. However, all these schools, they had their ups and downs. Only one of these schools remained to the present day, and that's the Theravada school. And that's what we have today in Sri Lanka, Burma, places like that. It's incidentally could be translated as something like Way of the Elders. So we had all these various schools, but only one made it to the 21st century. Hinayana. About 500 years after the death of the Buddha, there was an important offshoot. And that is referred to as the Mahayana. So again, you may have heard this term, Mahayana, which means greater area. You can imagine who came up with the terms, can't you? greater way and greater vehicle, something like that. The first evidence we have of its existence is about 500 years ago, but we can't be exactly sure. It may have existed before that time. We don't really know. And then another 500 years passed, and then we have the Vajrayana, Way of the Diamond Thunderbolt, or Tantra, Tantric Buddhism. The difference between Mahayana and Vajrayana is much less than the difference between these two and Hinayana. So this is what you have in countries such as Japan and China, because Zen is also a form of Mahayana, Vietnam, Tibet, and so on. So they tend to... Schools often are a blend of those two. Hinayana tends to only focus on, with one or two exceptions, only tends to have images of the Buddha himself, Shakyamuni Buddha. So they don't have the pantheon of other figures, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, that we have. That comes with the Mahayana. And then the Vajrayana, they have, in addition, wrathful deities, sexual imagery, and so on. Okay, with me so far? Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. The Theravada, the Hinayana, have really kept to the original Pali text. So we should be very grateful that they've kept the Pali text for us, the Pali canon, the word of the Buddha, from the time of the Buddha right up to now. So it's thanks to them that we have them. The Mahayana, though, has sort of built on the Buddha's teachings. They would argue that, although it's not necessarily the word of the Buddha, it nevertheless contains the spirit of the Buddha's teaching. You could also say, perhaps, that one lifetime is not enough to unpack the Buddha's teachings, all the consequences and ramifications of the Buddha's teaching. So deep and so profound and all-encompassing was it? Perhaps not even several lifetimes. So it's natural that it should develop over a period of time. Also, as Buddhism came into contact with other cultures, spread to other countries, and time passed and civilization changed, it found itself in different environments. And so that it's as if the original seed of the Buddha's teaching was planted in different soils and in different conditions, and as a result grew differently, as a result of that different environment. And so we have this Mahayana development of Buddhism. One of the principal, perhaps the principal idea of the Mahayana is the Bodhisattva ideal. So you may have heard of Buddhism Bodhisattvas, and a Buddha, of course, is an enlightened being. A Bodhisattva is similar. It's a being, an individual who's liberated themselves, but rather than choosing to disappear into wherever Buddhas disappear, they choose to be reborn continually into the world in order to help all other living beings, until all living beings whatsoever have been liberated. So that's a principal difference, really, and it reflects something of the nature of Hinayana and Mahayana of the time. The Hinayana had become very monasticized. It's very, based in monasteries and nunneries. And so the Mahayana was something of an attempt to reinvigorate and to go out into the world. And they would argue that it's based really upon the Buddha's example, how he, rather than just sitting quite happily, having gained enlightenment somewhere in a wood, he went out into the world to try and help other living beings. Now, another thing that happened during those early centuries was a process known as the Abhidharma. This is what the Hinayana schools went through, and it's an analysis of the nature of existence. So they're trying to break down existence, so everything, chairs, buildings, emotions, into the smallest possible units that they could do, which they confusingly called dharmas. So that's not dharmas as in the sense of the dharma, the teaching. It's just another use of the word, so they called them dharmas. And they were said to be indivisible. They were the smallest units of existence, various events and elements of existence. So they would be things like natural phenomena, like fire, water, air, qualities such as hardness, elasticity, temperature. Then it would be a mental state such as anger, envy, ill will, faith, compassion. And then things like space and nirvana, the state of enlightenment. So all these things were said to be units of existence. These were the dharmas. And it kind of developed to the stage where they tended to think that they had an intrinsic existence of their own. Now, they spent a lot of time with this. There was an awful lot of analysis about this. The different schools had all these different lists of dharmas. They had slightly different lists, but they had lists of dharmas, and there was lots of cross-referencing and so on and so forth. There was a lot of analysis of it. And if you've got a lot of time on your hands, perhaps that's okay. If you're a monk or a nun, and you don't have to get the kids to school and what have you, then you could perhaps spend the time on the analysis. But in terms of regular folks, I'm not sure that it would have been terribly helpful, really. In any case, it was a great intellectual exercise. The Mahayana, though, went further than this. They believed that these dharmas were not intrinsically existent in themselves. They believed that they were empty. So I need to introduce at this point a term that we're going to be using a lot, and that's shunyata, which is usually translated as emptiness or voidness. Or we use the word shunya, meaning empty or void. And so our Mahayana friends believe that these dharmas, these little elements of existence, didn't have an intrinsic existence of their own. They were empty. They were shunya. We will be looking into what this means a lot more over the coming weeks. But the whole purpose of... or the principal endeavour of the perfection of wisdom was looking at the emptiness, the shunyata of existence. It's a very subtle thing to try and explain shunya and shunyata, but there's one thing that I think that helps for me, and that's that I discovered not long ago. When the number zero, the concept of the number zero came into India, which was about in the 3rd century, it was given the name Shunya, which I think is interesting because zero, of course, is it's kind of nothing in a way, isn't it? I mean, if you've got zero apples, you've got no apples. But on the other hand, it's not nothing, is it? Because if it was nothing, you wouldn't really need the word for zero. It's useful sometimes to think of the term zero. So zero kind of is both something, and at the same time it's nothing. And that's really what we're talking about here with emptiness. And it's it happens to be the case that shunya is the word that is used for zero, even today in modern Hindi. So that's what we're kind of talking about with the nature of existence. These perfection of wisdom texts constitute the largest group and probably the most important group of Mahayana teachings. And it deals with transcendental wisdom, and in particular, this seeing the nature of existence as it really is. So I'll just say a little bit about the perfection of wisdom texts then, the historical story of the perfection of wisdom texts. There were a number of phases that they went through. So first off, between about 100 BCE or BC in old money, so 100 years before the birth of Christ, between then and 100 CE was the original development of the perfection of wisdom texts, the fundamental texts, that's to say the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines and an important summary of that document. There was another phase from 100 to 300, when these texts grew and expanded, and there was a great deal of analysis of them. So we had the perfection of wisdom in 25,000 lines, and then we had the perfection of wisdom in 100,000 lines. So that would take a lot of studying, really. And then there was another phase from 300 to 500, where there was a contraction, which probably just as well, really, where it was essentialized or summarized down. So during that period, we had the Heart Sutra, which you're familiar with, which is its true name is translated as the heart of the perfection of wisdom. So it's, you know, the essence of the perfection of wisdom in the Heart Sutra. We have various dharanis, which are magical formulae, mantras, and even the perfection of wisdom in one letter. So we've gone from 100,000 lines to one letter. So you might be wondering, perhaps, what is that one letter that can describe the perfection of wisdom? Well, as a matter of fact, it's the letter A. And the reason for that is because in Sanskrit, the letter A is a prefix, means not. You might have heard the term ahisma. Hisma means suffering. Ahisma means no suffering, not suffering. And so A is a prefix, means not. And actually, we have the same thing in English today. We have political and apolitical, sexual and asexual. So it's the same thing. So what they're trying to get at with that is, whatever you can conceive of as the nature of existence, whatever you can come up with, whatever text you can write, whatever picture you can draw, that's not it. Mm-hmm. You can only approximate, you can only point at it. And that's fine, as long as we realise that. And that's really what the Heart Sutra is trying to get about, with all the negations within it, which we'll be looking at in more detail in week three. So, we have the Heart Sutra in there. The Perfection of Wisdom in one letter. And then the Tantra got hold of it for about 500 or 600 years. And then we have the development of this figure here, for example. Pragya Paramita, the Perfection of Wisdom, as a female deity, a goddess. So she arose at that time, as well as various meditation practices as well. So the Perfection of Wisdom is not a set of systematic treatises where they try to sort of just simply explain the nature of things. Instead, it tries to get over it tries to express itself via paradoxical images and metaphors. So it can be quite confounding sometimes. Not straightforward. There was a school of Buddhism, which I'll also write up, called the Majjhimas. Majjhimaka school. And they tried to form a scriptural basis of the... They tried to systematise Perfection of Wisdom. So they involved themselves with the Perfection of Wisdom. Majjhimaka could be translated as middlemost, which is... interesting, really, because it takes us back to the Buddha's middle way, of course, and it's accurate in their view of the nature of existence. They're not saying that the elements of existence, our emotions and all the things around us, have some actual existent, substantial nature, but neither are they saying that they're non-existent. Sometimes you hear Buddhas saying things like that, you know, I don't exist, you don't exist, nobody exists. But the Majjhimakas are not saying that. They're going somewhere between. All things are empty. This brings in Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna is regarded by many to be the founder of the Majjhimaka tradition. Although he himself said that the Buddha wasn't just the forerunner, the Buddha was the founder of the movement. So let's look at Nagarjuna then. Now, Nagarjuna is a bit of a difficult character in some ways because we don't know a huge amount about him. We know less about Nagarjuna than we do about the Buddha. And his life is shrouded in myth and so on. So there are a couple of stories, first of all, I can relate. One was that he was an adept at magical powers. And as a young man, he used his magical powers to try to seduce the ladies of the court, like I suppose many young men would use their magical powers if they had it. So he would use his power of invisibility to go to the court and try to seduce the young ladies. But on one occasion, he got caught by the palace guards and nearly killed. And so from this, he realised that craving leads to suffering. And so he thought the best thing would be to... study Buddhism. Another legend says that when he was born, there was a prophecy that his parents were given that he would live only 7 years. And so as the seventh year approached, they became a bit anxious about this. And so they thought that if he could become a Buddhist, that he could perhaps overcome this karma by the force of good karma. So they sent him off to Nalanda, which is a massive university in northern India, not far from Vulture's Peak in Rajgir, as a matter of fact. He did very well there, and eventually became abbot of Nalanda. Unfortunately, though, it's a bit doubtful, that story, because the only archaeological evidence of Nalanda is from the 5th century, whereas Nagarjuna was born in the 3rd century. So that might be a bit fanciful. Nevertheless, he was, as far as we can tell, an adept at magical practices as well as meditation. Such to such an extent that the Naga king, dwelling in the deep ocean, realized that this chap had been born who was worthy of being given the perfection of wisdom texts. So he called him down into the great ocean and gave Nagarjuna these perfection of wisdom texts. Nagarjuna studied them, buried himself in them, really. He found more texts, loads and loads of more texts. And he realized that actually there was no end to what could be written about the Dharma and no end to what could be studied. But that in itself wasn't necessarily very helpful. What was important was a realization. So he took away some of these texts and spent his time meditating upon them until he had developed a great realization of the perfection of wisdom. And from that point, he was then able to pass that realization on to other people, or at least endeavor to do so. And so he spent much of the rest of his life doing just that. He also wrote some quite significant texts of his own, and I know that Singhanabha is going to be focusing on one of those in particular over the 2 evenings that he has. But he's most known for his association with the Majjhima school and with the perfection of wisdom. So because of this legend whereby the perfection of wisdom was kept in the deepest ocean, kept safe by the Nagas, it perhaps can give us we could perhaps take from that that actually these teachings were kept by a group of adepts, Buddhist adepts, maybe for many centuries before they were eventually revealed to the world by Nagarjuna. So that might have what actually happened. And the oceans are commonly said to represent the unconscious mind, whereas Nagas are sometimes they're thought of as dragons, but more often they're represented, particularly in India, as being great snakes, in particular cobras. And in fact, the Hindi word for cobra is Naga these days. And cobras, king cobras and so on, have great big hoods that they raise often when they're about to bite you. But they can be said, they're also said to be the guardians of bodies of water, rivers and lakes and oceans and so forth, and also guardians of treasure. They could be said to represent our imaginative faculties. So we can see, perhaps, from the legend that the perfection of wisdom is not something that comes from the intellect, but it is rather something that comes from the imaginative faculties that wells up from the unconscious, transcendental dimension of the unconscious. Nagarjuna wasn't born with the name Nagarjuna. He was given the name, and there are a couple of legends about how that came about. One says that on one particular occasion, it's another hot day in India, and he was teaching the perfection of wisdom, and it was so hot, the sun was beating down on everybody, and these 6 Nagas came along, and they raised themselves up above Nagarjuna's head, extended their hoods, and protected him from the sun like a parasol. Which is much like, you might have seen an image of the Buddha, where there's a great Naga, great king cobra, protecting him from the rain. But on this occasion, it was the sun. So that was how he said to have got the name Naga. And the other part of his name was said to come from the fact that his teachings went straight to the heart like an arrow. And Arjuna was a famous archer of the time, apparently. So he got the name Nagarjuna. So it could be something like the serpent king whose teaching goes straight to the heart like an arrow. Another legend, though, says that because he retrieved the teachings from the Nagas, he was given the name Nagarjuna, which means noble serpent. So as I said previously, Nagarjuna is so renowned that he was known by some people as the second Buddha. His philosophy was a real watershed, not just in Indian philosophy, but in philosophy general, because he was prepared to challenge that which was taken as axiomatic. He was prepared to question those things that other people had ordinarily accepted. He said, concerning the nature of phenomena, that all experience phenomena are empty. This does not mean that they are not experienced and therefore non-existent, only that they have no permanent existence of their own. So again, he's emphasizing the nature of existence, of the emptiness, this ungraspable nature of our experience and of the world around. He was also instrumental in the development of the Two Truths doctrine, which is a very important piece of Buddhism, I think, which says that there are two levels of truth. There is an ultimate level of truth, and there is a provisional or superficial level of truth. An example of this from our world perhaps could be this glass, for example. Because the glass is solid, right? But it's not, is it really? It's because, of course, the glass is made up of molecules. Molecules, there's lots of gaps between the molecules, which is just space. The molecules are made up of atoms, and there's just mostly space between atoms. And the atoms themselves are mostly space. It's said that an electron flying around the nucleus of an atom is much like a fly flying around the inside of a cathedral. That's how much space there is. And then the electrons in the nucleus themselves aren't really solid. We don't really know what they are, whether they're particles or waveforms or probability waveforms or what have you. So to say that it's solid is just absurd. It's not solid at all. And that's the ultimate truth, because that is ultimately the case. But nevertheless, if I'm on a glass of water, it's useful to think of the glass in terms of it being solid. And so that's the conventional or superficial truth. But ultimately, it's not true at all. So it can be with Buddhism as well, because ultimately we don't exist, it's said, as individuals, as independent, isolated selves. And so why practice ethics? If there's no individual to benefit, then who are you practicing ethics for anyway? So that may be an ultimate way to view things, but until we've actually realised the ultimate nature of reality, it would be foolish, perhaps, to think in that way. Much better to think in terms of conventional truth, using things like the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, until we arrive at enlightenment one day, perhaps, when we don't need to worry about the conventional truths, because we would just behave spontaneously, ethically. So we have that Two Truths doctrine. And also, he provided the Majjhimaka, the Mahayana movement, with a philosophical basis. And as I said, he's regarded by most later Majjhimaka schools as their founder. So, Nagarjuna revealed the Perfection of Wisdom text. But why does this matter? Who cares? More importantly, why does it matter to us? Bhante Sangharakshita, who's not on our shrine at the moment, but it's a founder of our movement, has said that the only way that you can reach reality is by destroying all your ideas about reality. So much like the Perfection of Wisdom in one letter, or in the Heart Sutra, we must get rid of all the certainties that we have. And the Majjhimaka school and the Perfection of Wisdom concerns itself with trying to discern the true nature of reality, to try and realise the empty nature of reality, to try and see reality in all things, at all times, everywhere. And so if we're concerned with seeing the true nature of reality, we should perhaps be concerned with the Perfection of Wisdom too. If, for example, we sometimes feel anger arising, or envy, or ill will towards other people, then that's our sense of self being solidified, concretizing. It's as if we feel we have something that's been hard done by, something that needs to be defended, our sense of self. And until we can see through that sense of self, we will never get rid of our suffering. As it says in the, or to paraphrase the Heart Sutra, if we're interested in sundering the bonds of our suffering, then the perfection of wisdom is an extremely important ally. I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.